Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Show tapes live some Thursdays on YouTube, channels A and N Zach. Check my Twitter feed, ActionZaku, for more. I hope you enjoy the show. Hey everybody, welcome to AnCast. My name is Zach Birchie, joined by a very special guest this week. A legend in the European anime market, for sure. Founder of the Scotland Loves Anime Film Festival and Anime Limited, the UK and Europe's, one of the major distributors for anime in the UK and Europe, Andrew Partridge. Andrew, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
I feel like you and I have been in the same circles for like 20 years and have just never met somehow.
I'm pretty sure we've passed at parties before.
Yeah.
A day X at least.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Absolutely. I don't doubt it for a second. So I guess first, like, congratulations on all your success. Like, Anime Limited seems like it's going great. Scotland's Anime seems like it's going great. I wanted to start with your history as a fan. Tell us about your early days as a fan.
So I started working for Bandai of all people back in late 2004, doing translation work for them from French to English, of all things. I've been into anime before that as well. I actually started with imported volumes of Ranma ½ from the US back when they were still ridiculously large. Size format, like among other things, basically, stuff like Ghost in the Shell, like Evangelion on VHS tape, etc. Got me started really in the UK, as it wasn't super accessible where I lived at that time. Otherwise, and from that I ended up indirectly working for Bandai, translating French to English for their Bandai Entertainment's European sister company called Bees. And one thing led to another, and I ended up doing an internship there, back in 2000 and early 2005. Never really found the door after that. The person above me quit, so the French intern and myself ended up taking on a lot of the work.
Yeah,
and turned out I was actually okay. Well, not okay. I was taught a lot about acquisition and became. Ended up working on acquisitions for Bees back in the day. And then one thing led to another, and I started working at a company called Kaze about the same time as I started a film festival called Scotland Loves Anime. And then one thing led to another from there, basically, and I ended up leaving Kaze along with its founder at the time, we'd been there for over 20 years at that point, and started Anime Limited.
Right.
Kind of a complete, in a pricey summary, I guess that's it.
Well, what a story. I mean, there's a lot of ambition in there, and yeah, that's kind of an incredible story. That's fascinating, and I want to talk about Bandai, but before we do that, though, I do want to know, like, in the early days, what was it for you? What got you into anime?
I think it was the fact that, it was animation that was also aimed at not just kids.
Right.
I mean, a lot of the stuff which broke through into the UK, like Akira, Ghost in the Shell, Ninja Scroll, etc., it was all animation that was aimed at not necessarily just adults with the old manga entertainment reputation behind it, but just stories which weren't just for children in animated format, and it was kind of that which hooked me in. The amount of adult animation in the West that's not just for laughs is very, it's very limited, at least. It's not impossible to find, but for every Waltz with Bashir you get, there's at least 10 pieces of animation aimed at children.
Yeah, and the example that immediately comes to mind is Waltz with Bashir, which at this point is how many years old?
Exactly that and Persepolis at the time.
Yeah.
Like, two of the only, or like said, was the only two which really, like, really leapt out at me around that time.
Yeah.
But, like, I mean, whereas with Japanese animation, it's not that all of it is aimed at adults or teenagers, but there's a lot broader mix. There's a lot broader mix of content, basically, for it. In my, like, in my eyes at the time when I was younger anyway.
Right. Yeah, totally. I think that's the, I feel like, yeah, in, you know, this is in no way to diminish it, but that sounds like a very relatable and common origin story for an anime fan of, say, our age. You know, like, that stuff was the gateway drug, and it was really, really powerful, like, to the point of motivating someone like you to do all of that. Like, that I think that's a fairly incredible story. But I'm really curious about this film festival. So Scotland Loves Anime is in its eighth year this year.
Ninth, would you believe?
Right. Okay. Well, So founded in 2010. So right. In those early days, what about it? Like, what about starting a film festival seemed like, this is it, I got to do this.
I'm pretty sure it was a terrible idea at the time.
Okay.
Still survived to this point as it's an everlasting surprise and joy for me, to be honest. Film festival, well, I mean, it seemed like an idea at the time because anime was still, like, I mean, anime was not in its infancy anymore in the UK at this point, but in 2010 by far, but it was still early on in the days of simulcast, and more importantly than that, for me, anime, like, film was still being treated as a way of luring, anime film was still being used as a way of luring either teenagers in to film festivals to get the numbers up, or, like, a way, like, or it was the new Studio Ghibli, so it was aiming at the family audience. It wasn't really a look at Japanese animation as, like, as a medium, as the kind of the broad strokes, everything from, you know, Belladonna of Sadness all the way along to, like, something more family-friendly, like K-On!, for example. Like, there was just no delineation, and it's like any medium, like, as a whole, there's always interesting bits in between that get left out when it's used to kind of hook in a smaller demographic, you know?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. That's an interesting thing, though, that you'd program anime just to cushion the numbers.
Well, it's not so much just cushion the numbers. It's just the fact that, I mean, it was the thing people were willing to pay for because it was so unusual to see anime on the big screen. It wasn't Ghibli. Sci-Fi London back in the day used to run an all-nighter. It was like Louis Savvy was on record as saying it was the most profitable element of Sci-Fi London.
Right.
It was a good way for anime fans to not only go and see the latest films from people like Manga Entertainment and ADV Films back in the day, but it was also a way to, like, to have a cheap hotel room overnight because you could fall asleep in the cinema and still wake up in central London the next day.
Right.
It was so unusual to see that, like, it brought out people whatever happened. So, I mean, there are some film programmers who just love Japanese animation as well, so it wasn't entirely just a trick to buff the numbers up, but very often, like, the overall bigger picture was that. So, and there was nothing which just looked at Japanese animation and film. You either had anime conventions or wider film festivals, which maybe had one anime film every few years,
mm-hmm.
but, like, didn't really have much else in that, barring things like the Leeds Film Festival has always been a strong supporter of anime and obviously Sci-Fi London. But it was not up in Scotland. So right. Basically, you could have everything, like, everything which went on, either had, like, if you were lucky once a year, Leeds had its segment, but everything else tended to happen in London for anime, especially for film.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it seemed inherently unfair that there was nothing in Scotland because there was definitely, as someone who grew up as part of the anime community in Scotland, but was definitely a community of people there. And it seemed really weird that there was no way to prove it. So that's kind of why I started to see if it was true or not. You know, was I just, like, was I barking up the wrong tree and there was nobody there? Or was there an actual audience waiting to happen? And the first year alone, the audiences were good. We had sellout screenings, like, in Edinburgh and Glasgow. And there was definitely an audience there. In fact, people began to travel after that from further afield. I mean, obviously people from England and Ireland and then Wales came to it. But we had people in the first year from France who came over to see the Haruhi movie, In 2012, we had someone from Japan come all the way over just to see the Naoko Yamada present, like, interview, Q&A session and the interview.
Wow.
Like, it was, like, and people traveled from a long way to come and see stuff, and it kind of evolved over time, you know. The key thing, though, for us was just to treat anime as something that was serious, I guess.
It's like just film. Well. It's just film, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe this is a little bit of a rabbit trail, but it occurs to me, I'm actually not super familiar with this. Did the UK have its own tape trading scene, its own fan sub tape trading scene?
It did, I think, at the time. It was a little bit before my time. I wasn't connected to the community at that point, but I'm pretty sure, like, Jonathan Clements and Helen, like, McCarthy would both have known about that.
Right.
That scene a lot better than I would have.
Right. Right. So you were a little after that period. And what your goal at that point was to basically pull anime out of the perceived sort of box it had been placed in at the time, and also combat the extremely limited availability and just make it so you can see this stuff in Scotland.
Yeah, exactly that. And it kind of evolved from there. And we kind of kept experimenting, kept trying to bring people up. We've toured it before as well across Scotland and actually across the UK once or twice. It takes a lot. It's very intensive work, though. And the trouble is, film festivals in themselves are not inherently profitable events. I mean, we don't make a penny really from the festival itself. I certainly don't.
Right.
But it's one of these things which is worth doing from the bigger picture of things as well. It's not like there's nothing to gain from doing it. You get to meet amazing people in the process, and I think it's still, even in today's environment where theatrical anime is a lot more possible, thanks to both people like Manga Entertainment's efforts and my own at Anime Limited, it still serves an important purpose, because you can't, there's a lot of new film coming out that needs screened, you can't curate as easily, and there's a huge value in having something that is both curated and well presented, you know?
Mm, yeah, exactly. How do you typically approach programming? Like, what's the first question that pops in your head? And, you know, what sort of films do you look for? I mean, obviously the best and brightest, but what do you look for?
What I look for is there a way to program Redline again for another year in a row. But
see, there you go. Now that's good thinking.
If only I could get away with it every single year, it'd be great. It packs out every time we do it. I mean, it's a film which resonates well with animators. But apart from that, first question is always just what's new for the year and what fits for competition. The goal being always to have things which are premieres in the competition slots. After that, it becomes a question of what we want to focus on. We try and either focus on a director or a studio as well. This year, I don't think it would surprise anyone to know that it's going to be Mamoru Hosoda we're focusing on.
Right.
It depends on what else there is out there as well. Some years we focused on things like science fiction in Japan. Other years we focused on a studio as well as a director. Like last year we focused on Madhouse, like as well as a director. It really depends on the year for it and what we like. The joy of being able to program these festivals is it gives us a lot of leeway to what films we'd like to see screened and then work out, like, if there's a theme around them or if we need to go back to the drawing boards. Theming things helps a lot when you program a strand. It just depends on, you need a solid kind of backbone of each strand before you set it up, though.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you do everything on digital, or is there any attempt or any desire to try and score film prints? I noticed in 2017 you were showing Venus Wars, and I was curious. Like, do you get the opportunity to get revival prints of these things?
I was gonna say, don't hold it against me for screening Venus Wars for starters. But
no, of course not. That's amazing, dude. I wish I was there.
It's like we run stuff when we have to. We run it digitally. We do really love 35mm though as well. We actually had in the first year of the festival, not advertised, but we actually had a 16mm print of Akira.
Wow!
So the titles were actually typed on the screen. I remember because me and
that's amazing.
Like Michael. Yeah, me and Michael Santernicholas were there, like, at the time and heading out, and we both sat down to watch a good chunk of it because both of us hadn't seen. This print just showed up. No one knows where this print is today, but the BFI dug it up from their archives and sent it up to the film house in Edinburgh to screen it.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems to have just popped up out of nowhere and disappeared again. I would have loved to have kept a hold of that, actually, now.
Yeah, really? No kidding. Yeah, if you said, like, yo, we found a 35mm print of The End of Evangelion and we're going to show it, I would get on a plane.
I know what you mean. Like, I mean, we've had several, like, we try and do that where we can. Like, in the first year, we also did a 35mm screening of the Cowboy Bebop movie.
Nice.
Last year we screened Metropolis on 35mm as well.
Yeah, these are like movies for which prints exist. Like, that's, yeah. You know.
The last time a 35mm print was actually created, like, well, that year was Wolf Children, the year of Wolf Children. We had the choice, actually, between what we wanted to screen. Did we want a DCP, which was cheaper, or 35mm? And the answer was obvious for us, you know, take the 35mm. It's a one-off experience, you know, to have a subtitle festival print for that.
Yeah, no kidding. Wow, that would have been incredible. I'm a huge, huge nerd for that, for that kind of thing. And the chance to see anime, like, specifically, like, in the theater now is a little bit more of a common thing, thanks to people like yourself. But film remains the elusive
oh, absolutely
the elusive experience.
In 2013 we had a real treat from Japan with Evangelion, so we had 1.0 and 2.0 on 35mm.
Wow.
Reel.
Nice. Man, that would have been cool.
I think 3.0 they moved over to purely digital for international, at least. I don't think there was any subtitle prints created.
Did they strike it on film in Japan? I mean, that was 2012 at that point.
Yeah, I don't think they did. I mean, well, I film 35mm did last a lot longer in Japan than anywhere else.
Right, yeah, but I don't know if as late as 2012 they're still putting animation on film. That I don't know, maybe. I'd be very curious to know. That's kind of your programming strategy. What can you tell us anything? Like, this year you mentioned Hosoda. Can we expect, like, a retrospective? Obviously, you're sort of interested in showing his new film, maybe?
Oh, absolutely. I would love to. I mean, it does help that it's also one of my titles at Anime Limited.
Right.
But it all depends. I mean, I'd love to screen it, but I definitely want to do a retrospective and do, if I can, all of his previous films. I'm a huge fan. It's one of the Girl Who Left for Time was one of those films that just reminded me why I loved working in this space. Has been, I know it's a film which brought a lot of people in the international space, especially in Europe, like, or back into the industry, or reminded us all of what we loved about what we do, you know?
Totally, yeah. Hey, you really want to pack them in. Find a 35mm print of Our War Game.
Oh, man. I mean, there's some interesting lineup stuff as well, from things like the things that Tokyo Film Festival did a couple of years back, where they did a focus on Hosoda as well, actually.
Oh, yeah.
I think they actually screened that at the festival. Like, I mean, I think they screened several of his older works, at least, pre-Girl Who Left Through Time.
Right.
Like, it was a really interesting short film program, combination of episodes, shorts. Apparently, I think he did some really interesting fashion adverts at the time as well.
Oh, cool. Wow. Interesting. So the film festival and your experience at Bees leads you to Anime Limited. You know, also sort of known as All the Anime. Can you explain that difference and maybe go into a little bit about these companies for our American listeners who might not be totally familiar?
Absolutely. So I mean, Anime Limited. We're kind of moving more towards that direction now, as branding was originally the main company name. So. Much like you would get, like, for example, in the USA, Group 1200, well, in pre-Sony at least, Group 1200, and then Funimation Productions or whatever, like the other companies they had at the time, you know, Giant Ape, etc. Like, Anime Limited was our kind of parent name, whereas the brand, like, in our case, it was less separate segmented companies, it's more just brands, because all the anime in France would mean all the animation, so... We had to shuffle things around. We're moving much more towards just calling ourselves Anime nowadays, or Anime Limited, just because it makes it a lot easier. It's kind of a shift we're making over time. But to give the background, so Bees was, like, jumping back to the beginning, Bees was one of the earlier companies, like the early late companies into the UK. So originally it was Manga Entertainment, there was also Inoki Films and a bunch of others. But around the time... like around the time of like where we came into like these came into the market, there was also manga, like for that time it was Manga Entertainment, ADV Films, and a company called MVM.
Mm-hmm. All right, yeah.
And like these was basically the like the sister company of Bandai Entertainment in the USA. As far as I know, it was understood as something like Bandai Entertainment European Zone. That's at least what we said to make sense of it. But basically the goal was to release anime across Europe. So UK, France, Germany, like Italy and Spain. Like I'm working obviously on the Bandai content, Bandai Sunrise content. So the catalog looked very similar to what you saw in the USA from Bandai Entertainment. Stuff like in the UK, Cowboy Bebop, Gundam Wing. In France, because of the way the Ghost in the Shell standalone complex rights were split, it was released in France by Bees, like originally, not by Manga Entertainment. There was a chunk of other like of other content, like not so popular in the English-speaking territories, but things like City Hunter, which was huge in France, and called Nicky Larson. A bunch of, like, basically a mix of the Bandai content as well, stuff like Arjuna, Clamp High School Detectives and such were mixed into the rights. So more later on down the line in the UK, stuff like Code Geass, like Malanke Palerita, can never pronounce it when I start saying it, Harry Susumiya, right. Basically, right. Series, and like Angeren Lagan fell to Bandai, like Bandai as well, after the whole initial ADV announcement saga back in the day. So it was kind of like around that time, like that era where just pre the first burst of companies going out of business, or shuttering their doors, etc., like and transferring their rights, etc. So it was an interesting time, like all in all the bees, and it kind of like after it shuttered its doors, etc., and I moved on, I ended up working for what was called Kaze at the time. It's still called Kaze in France, but it's Viz Media Europe to everyone else nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
So part of that group, the owner, like the original founder of the company, and I met at Anime, well, what was Tokyo Anime Fair at the time, once, and we hit it off pretty well. I actually was looking for a job at the time because obviously Bandai was shuttering its doors, and I went into the interview expecting to meet the person in charge of the merchandise department, and was walked into Cedric's office actually at the time, and was told, "Well, your CV totally isn't suitable for a merchandising job, but you know, we want to see what we can do with you because the CV is good." So I had to write my own job spec and come back to him within a week, which did not make it easy, I have to say.
You had to come up with your own duties?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was a test to see if I had the initiative to come up with something that made sense and to try and develop a market, really. And if I wasn't going to be able to do that, then I'd be useless for developing business in the UK or anywhere.
Right.
So as time went on, I started to work more and more on acquisitions again at that point. And when Cedric's period at Kaze, when his golden handcuff period came to an end, he decided to go and pursue new ventures. The idea came up of, like on my side, of starting Anime Limited. Because for as long as I can remember, there's been a stigma in the UK market about collector's editions before. Basically, before Bees started doing stuff, and like certainly it wasn't common even then. Even basic things like a collector's box to hold things in was not super common. The only other company to do them was like consistently and more often even than Bandai in the UK was ADV Films at the time. And they were very much mirroring what they did in the USA a lot of the time. If it wasn't for the hard work of people like Hugh David back in the day there, like it would have all been identical. People like Hugh David put a lot of effort into differentiating. But there was still this common perception that there was just no market for collectors in the UK market because it was too small. So when I started Anime Limited, the key goal was to create interesting kind of high-end collector's editions, like long-term, and prove that there was a market. And we started with Cowboy Bebop through a fortuitous set of circumstances for us, basically, at the time. And it basically proved, I mean, the first release, we sold like a massive amount of units in the first year, like which I think pretty much resonated, like resoundingly told us there was definitely a market there that we'd be missing up until now. Right. So that's a kind of a long and windy summary, I guess. But
no, it totally makes sense. So in those early days, what were your ideas for growing the UK market? Like, what did you come up with? And, you know, obviously you had some success with that, but what were your ideas? Like, how did the UK market seem to you?
Well, ever since we like started in the industry at Bees, the market always seemed like it was ready to grow. It's just that when you find something good, it's very difficult to change a model. So if standard editions are working and selling high and cheap into general retail, like especially when there was a lot of physical stores out there were really willing to take the content, it's very difficult to different, like, to kind of go off the beaten track and try a model that seems very dangerous, you know?
Right, yeah.
So moving into the time where people like HMV went out of business and then came back, places like Virgin shuttered their doors and never came back, and the whole chain of companies which went down during that whole debacle basically presented a new opportunity. And I don't know, I always saw the market, the UK market, as bigger than was out, like than was actually buying content just now, but there was room to grow it, you know, to nurture it.
Yeah.
Try and show, I mean, the goal for Anime Limited was always just to show people things we really like. And they may not see otherwise, or they may see otherwise. I mean, I'd be lying if I said we licensed only niche content and tried to make it incredibly popular. I mean, we've had titles like Cowboy Bebop, Tokyo Ghoul, Your Name, Silent Voice, like the list goes on between film and TV series there. But we've also, for every time we've licensed something like that, we've licensed, you know, the Tatami Galaxy, we've licensed Belladonna of Sadness, Tokyo Marble Chocolate.
Yeah.
There's a lot of variety.
Yeah, it's a lot of stuff that over here, it's only boutique publishers really touch it. Like Belladonna of Sadness was like a very niche label that released it over here. It wasn't even an anime distributor. So that's cool. And actually that's one of the questions I had for you about all the anime. I think the thing that Western fans in America, if they're familiar with, a British, anime distributor in the first place, it is because you can gloat about your, relatively lower priced special editions of high-priced Aniplex shows. So, in other words, I remember there being a big kerfuffle over the fact that the UK got this glorious Gurren Lagann Blu-ray box, complete, reasonably priced, and then the Aniplex box is like $600 or something, and everyone just goes, ugh, and just sits over here and stews with jealousy. And I've noticed, like, looking at the All the Anime page right now, your catalog is full of Aniplex products, and I have Aniplex of America's version of it sitting here, and your version is a bit different. Can you tell us a little bit about how that licensing works?
I'm sure. I mean, it's really straightforward, actually.
I'm sure.
I'm afraid it's a really boring story at the end of the day. I mean, ultimately, we license the content from our friends at Aniplex of America, and then we work out a release model in association with them that makes, a degree of sense. I mean, on a controversial note, while it's not an easy thing to have to do, I totally understand the problems Aniplex of America faces. If it had been us with the same region code as Japan, we would be facing almost identical problems now, and because of our market size, we would all be out of business in the UK. Back in the day with DVD, for example, actually back when counter importation was still a very a grey area, people weren't really paying too much attention to it. Manga UK had to give Jonathan Clements a call and go, well, we've just had a massive spike in our Ghost in the Shell standalone complex box set sales on DVD. Can you look into it, please, and see if you can find anything about it, because we're drawing up blanks here. And what they found out was someone on one of the Japanese message boards had posted, have you seen this? I mean, it's in the UK. It costs barely one volume of the 12 for Ghost in the Shell standalone complex, or whatever the volume count was at the time. And the best part of it is the subtitles you can turn off on the DVD. So you can, and you can order it from Amazon UK or where .co.uk or wherever you like. And that caused a huge amount of problems in the UK for DVD releases afterwards. And it was no one's fault. You know, we hadn't advertised, no one had advertised that was the case, but it was certainly a huge problem, even with the pound to the yen rate at the time. And so I can totally, we were caught in the previous generation of media's problems with that, you know, back when people still really cared about DVD, globally. Now it's all about Blu-ray. It's an unfortunate situation for America as a whole, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't make it better for everyone in the USA, though, and I totally respect that. But the trade-off for us normally to do what we do is the release is often very much later than Aniplex of Americas, for example.
Right.
I mean, for us, for example, I mean, take Sword Art Online Ordinal Scale just now. We're releasing it a lot later. You know, it's coming out in May in the UK, whereas the USA has had it for, I think, pre-Christmas.
Yeah. No, I've had it on my shelf for a while. So, yeah. Yeah, I guess that's the trade-off. It wasn't, I mean, in the case of Gurren Lagann, though, I'm fairly certain you got it before we did.
Yeah.
Something like that. That was a special case, I think.
That was. It's kind of an odd case because it's not a first run title. The title's been, I mean, honestly speaking, B's released an Anime Legends version, and so did Bandai, like back in the day in the USA. So the titles had a lot of fluctuations in pricing, you know?
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's changed a lot. And, you know, that's, I think that's my next question for you is, like, over the years, what would you say has been your biggest challenge as a distributor in the UK? Like, what's the hardest part about it?
Well, I think right now, like, it probably leads on to some stuff later, is the ever-growing, looming, or whatever looming, I guess, is a better description of it, shadow of globalization.
Okay.
And I think it's always been that way. It's just, this industry is a bit like a wheel, really, and you kind of hope it has 12 spokes instead of 5 sometimes, so you're not too quickly back to the same point again.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, at the end of the day, like, globalization has always been the biggest challenge for the UK, especially. For France, for Europe, less so, to an extent. But the UK is always caught up in whatever happens in America. Same for Australia very often, you know?
Right, because of language.
Language and the money. I mean, the market size is larger in the USA compared to the UK.
Yeah.
So it's easy enough to put an extra bit of money on top to buy UK rights or Australian rights, for example, and it's very hard to compete often with that. I mean, barring that, I would say the biggest challenge throughout the years is just the same one everyone faces, trying to adapt to the changing times, you know. I mean, like, digital came in and everyone became obsessed for a time with having a platform. I obviously went through that phase as well. You know, I had to work on things like Anime On Demand with Kaze back in the day. Like, obviously, look, there's platforms like Animax, which came up in the UK again, like, moving in from Germany and Japan from Sony. Like digital was probably the first big one to adapt, and I think that's what also helped usher back in things like collector's editions to the UK market too.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, but I think, like, changing with the times and the ever-growing face of globalization, I think, has been the two biggest ones in a nutshell.
Well, to wit, in terms of globalization, what you're talking about chiefly is the fact that, say, for instance, Funimation can just begin distributing their product in your territory, and then there's really no reason for all the anime to license to show themselves because that's the product that you would eventually put out. So, is it safe to say you adapted to that by just becoming Funimation's UK distributor?
I think it's fair to say that it was I think it's an option everyone in the UK market has been through once.
Okay.
MVM distributed back in the day initially, mm-hmm, for Funimation. Then they moved on to Manga UK. After a brief stop at Revelation Films in between, which was owned by the Navarre Group, they then went to, like, so after moving to Manga UK after the Navarre Group, for a long time, they then came to us. Then they briefly went to Universal, and now obviously are with Sony. So, I mean, I think the next shop for them is Warner or Universal at this point.
Oh, right. Okay.
No, jokes aside, I mean, I think finding content is always the chief problem, and that's one we've always looked at. For us, it was an interesting partnership to see what would come of it, and it's like, it's one of those ones. I mean, we're still acquiring content directly as well. And actually, like, I mean, our direct content line remained pretty strong and still has to this day. So, I mean, it's one of those things where, I mean, it's about learning where globalization fits in.
Right. Yeah, totally. Yeah, I don't know. That seems like a real challenge.
It is, but I mean, everyone adapts differently to it, you know? I mean, like, honestly, like, Funimation's content is very interesting as well, actually. So, I mean, when we took it on, it was, like, each time there's been a nice kind of iteration to the release. Everyone has done something differently and not in a, like, honestly speaking, not in a bad way. I think it's all benefited Funimation's growth in the UK market, like, over time. So as much as I joke that they've been, like, they've changed hands a lot of times in the UK, I think it's actually benefited the content overall as well, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that definitely makes sense. Here's a question. Are you concerned at all about Sony? I have heard myself a lot of concern about the impact that Sony's going to have on Funimation's overall video business, and it's going to change, you know, scuttlebutt that's going to change everything about it. Do you think that's going to impact you?
Well, I think it's like, it's not going to impact us so much. I mean, we do our own thing pretty much. So does people like Manga UK, like, and MVM, you know? I mean, I think the thing which would impact us is if somehow content stopped being released for some reason, you know, because the current lineup, due to the relationship between Funimation and Crunchyroll, for example, means that they control a large swathe of the market as content comes out just now on TV series. And there's no sign of that just now. I mean, honestly, once, like, in this kind of situation, change, like, may happen or it may not happen, you know? I mean, Funimation's a pretty healthy company from everything I've seen.
Well, so, I guess more my question was, like, are you concerned at all that Sony will say, well, we don't need to go through a third party in the UK, another vendor in the UK, we will use our existing Sony distribution channels in Europe? I think that's more the question.
No, I'm sure that will, like that would happen at some point, you know? I mean, right. Like, it's a natural process. I mean, Sony released Attack on Titan Season 2 in the UK, for example, in February time.
Oh, okay. All right, so it's already kind of happening.
I mean, yeah, like, I mean, but, like, at the end of the day, there's always a need for local intelligence in anime. I mean, anime is, while an interesting and, like, dare I say it, even long-term a profitable space to be in worldwide, it does require local knowledge in every territory. It's really interesting to me because I remember a conversation back in 2007 or so, like, it's an MCM Comic Con with people from, like, a few of us in the industry got together for a chat. I think it was actually Hugh David there at ADV who we were discussing this, and this seemed like the way things would go, you know, where the companies internationally became more of a kind of a black box to input and output, like marketing information and advice, like general promotion, event attendance, that kind of stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we're there yet, but I think, like, it wasn't far off where the market was evolving to, you know? It just took a bit longer, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it seems like y'all are just, like, a, you know, I don't know, 5-6 years culturally, in terms of, like, the spread, reach, popularity, just a little bit behind America. Like, just
That's not an unfair point of view, to be honest.
You know, but the same thing happens in, like I always characterize the manga industry as being a little bit behind the anime industry. That's not behind as in somehow not as advanced, I guess, but, like, it's weird how you can chart the phases of an industry. So, like, anime went through a terrible reckoning with its piracy problem. Manga went through a terrible reckoning with its piracy problem. Like, maybe 4 or 5 years later, anime went through a terrible reckoning with a retail foreclosure. Manga went through a terrible reckoning with retail, like, just a few years later. So it's interesting to see, like, the conditions that you're describing are a little similar to the US just a few years later, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair point of view on it, to be honest. It's an interesting thing because it's a very English-speaking territory problem. I mean, it's definitely not the case in France or Germany, for example, like, or Italy or Spain, for that matter, where the manga industry is almost like, leaps and bounds ahead of the anime space, basically, in terms of timing, which always never ceases to amaze me, because, if I hadn't worked in the French industry on and off for so long, or at least been tangential to it, so I had a very, like, a good passenger seat view of it, like, I wouldn't have believed it, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. So, can you share with us a little bit some of your bestsellers over the last, like, 6 months? Like, what, any surprises?
Oh, well, I mean, no surprise, but Your Name is obviously a very big seller for us.
Yeah, sure.
A Silent Voice, unsurprisingly, has done very well for us.
Yeah, you guys got that way before we did, I think.
It does seem that way. I mean, yeah. I'm sure it's about at some point for the US.
It's due out soon. They did show it in theaters. So
that's good.
We've had that.
I think there's dub screenings coming as well, right?
I think so. I bought it off UK iTunes last year. I think I paid you for it, actually.
Yeah, in fact, you would have long term, so thank you very much.
No problem.
I definitely can't complain at that. Honestly, those two were like the ones which kind of blew everything out of the water for us.
Yeah, that was a weird... Yeah.
last year and into this year, to be honest. I mean, Napping Princess is doing pretty well just now.
Is it? Okay, that's good to hear, because it got a very muted reception, I noticed, here in the States.
Like, it's an interesting film. Like, I think it's, like, last year was definitely an interesting year for filming. My favorite film of the year, I think, was probably actually Night is Short, Walk on Girl, I mean. But that's just because I'm a huge fan of the Tatami Galaxy back in the day. But, I'd say, like, it's so hard to pick out titles after Your Name in a silent voice, because the way those two spiked the market in the last 6 months for us kind of blow everything else out of the water. Obviously, Gurren Lagann remains a constant seller for us, and the new box set we did back in summer last year, which I think just is past the six-month mark, did very well for us. Other titles which remain, it's interesting how some of the classics remain the strong ones as well. Cowboy Bebop remains a constant seller for us, unsurprisingly.
Right.
It's one, like, there's always interesting things. And things like when we do our ultimates, there tends to be an interesting spike in how those do as well. So, there's quite a diverse mix of what works, both new and old, you know?
Yeah, totally. Totally. All right. Okay, let's go ahead and take some of these Twitter questions. I got a few of them here. Stefan asks, do you think Glasgow could supplant LA as the main location for anime premieres in the Anglosphere?
Tough question. I think it's unlikely that either will surpass the other. I mean, both territories are important. For example, LA got the premiere of Your Name, like the world premiere of Your Name, in fact, as I believe it was. Or at least like the international one at the very least, you know. The UK got the world, like the international premiere of A Silent Voice. To just give a most recent example, I don't think LA has any risk of being eclipsed anytime soon. what I would settle for is the UK becoming the LA of the UK, at least, or Europe. For premieres, that would be my target. I don't want to compete with LA on that frontier.
Yeah, really. Okay, let's see.
Well, I'd settle for the temperature, though. I mean,
Andrew McGee asks, despite being a smaller market than the US, all the anime tends to have more limited collector's edition offerings. Is it just a matter of the local UK market, or are there other factors influencing this? Do these fancier sets help push international sales?
Hard to tell for international sales. It's really actually bizarrely hard to track where stuff goes, really, without doing some really bizarre sums. But I would say what does it for us is, because we're a small company, it's the final decision ends at me, and it's easier to take a risk when you're making a decision that, like, that impacts a smaller number of people and everyone's willing to take the same risk, you know? Ultimately, though, an edition like this, it works because there's always a limited number of people interested in particularly niche titles, you know, like the Tatami Galaxy, for example, which I love, but good luck trying to sell it to a wider market beyond anime fans, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, in the UK, if you can print less units, like, because you don't have to watch, like, you know, it's subtitled only, for example, so there's no dub to amortize, it can work that way. I mean, if you're only printing 1,000 units and your break-even is good, like, then, like, it's not a huge risk, you know, long-term. I mean, it may not break even month one, like, for some titles, but it's still, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and as long as it comes out in the wash eventually, because we do horribly still have to be capitalist companies as a company anyway, because I do like keeping the lights on and my staff fed and watered, you know?
We talked about this a little earlier. Chio Dore asks, there's traditionally been a large period of time between the US and UK when it comes to physical releases of anime titles. Would you say that, compared to when you first started watching anime, that the gap has increased, shrunk, or stayed the same?
You know what? I would say it's actually stayed the same on the big picture of things.
Really?
I mean, some titles take long. Well, I mean, like, some titles take longer to release. Some titles are quicker. I think if you put them all together, you'd find not all that much has changed, just that digital has changed our perception of release dates for home video, you know? I mean, because something we can watch something now day and date, like thanks to like the good folks at Funimation and Crunchyroll, and Co. Basically, there's so many different ways to watch for content on day one legally. You know, there's even Netflix and Amazon nowadays and such. I mean, the fact that you're watching it day one instead of having to wait for someone to fan sub it or wait for someone to release a stopgap measure on it. I think it skews our point of view because the clock starts to, I don't know about anyone else, but the clock starts ticking for me from the minute I watch the episode to when it's available on home video. And the fact that we can now watch things sooner and sooner means that really we're starting that clock sooner and sooner. So yes, some companies still delay, so us especially at Anime Limited, you know, we still delay titles due to a plethora of problems with release, you know, like normally due to materials or approvals or the other fun pack things that go on, you know, in the process. But like the truth is, I think delays happened before as well. It's just there was less of a frame of reference, I guess, from day one. That became a lot more philosophical than I expected it to be.
Wow. All right. No, I totally understand that. Ajax Ranger asks, has there ever been anything you wanted to put in your collectors or ultimate editions but haven't been able to? For example, the Gurren Lagann OVA. Side note, when Harmony Gold are finally smited, can we rely on you to try and give Macross the release it deserves?
I would love to give Macross the release it deserves. I think there's going to be a very long queue of distributors looking to do that, though. It's like, yeah, I would love to do that. I mean, in terms of releases, things we'd have loved to include in our releases, I'm sure there have been things over the years. I think at the end of the day, though, I mean, we've always been taught to be like, some of the lessons I learned when I was back at Bees and starting up Scotland Loves Anime and such was just to always be flexible, you know? So I guess we don't spend too much time dwelling on what we're not allowed to include and try and focus on what we can include or what kind of clever workarounds we can get to release something. So, for example, it's about more about what you can protect in a release. So there's one title which will remain nameless. Actually, like in this, just for the sake of my own well-being, I don't want anyone knocking on my door later. But like where we basically just had to keep going through approval like month after month after month until eventually like they started correcting their own corrections. So we were able to just say, well, it seems like you're flagging your own corrections. Can you tell us what actually needs fixed now? And the next day we got an email saying your designs have been approved, please go to print. You know, so it took a long time to work around it, but we just weren't willing to give up on including that extra in that set because it was the perfect one for it. And it doesn't always work that way, but I mean, I guess you just have to accept that sometimes there's a reason or sometimes the reason is hard to see, but you just have to accept that if you're told you can't play with that toy, then you have to look at what you can and try and make things work, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
Sometimes it turns a bit more MacGyver-esque to make something work.
Right, yeah.
Nonetheless.
Let's see. Chuo Dori asks, what anime series or films have you imported from the US for Andrew? Or from the UK for us? I have not imported. I guess I bought a Silent Voice, so there's that.
Yeah, I was going to say, you set yourself up for that one.
I think I bought a Blu-ray and had it shipped. That's what I think. I don't really think like I bought the digital movie from you, so I guess that's why it didn't come to mind. But yeah.
So what did I import from the USA back in the day? I would definitely say Rurouni Kenshin when it came out.
Right.
Because that's never had a physical release in the UK barring the OVAs, which was a shame. Of all things, actually, before it was released in the UK by Bees was Cowboy Bebop. Right. I remember getting very impatient for Raz Efon back in the day and importing some copies of later volumes from the USA as they were well ahead of the UK's release schedule. I think also actually the first volume of Wolf's Rain when it came with the soundtrack. So I just really love Yoko Kanno's soundtracks.
Right. Yeah, I mean, well, you know, I feel like that's a...
That's a decent list, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, last couple here. Okay, I guess this is our last question. From Rob StockX, he asks, as one of the few English Region 2 publishers, have you ever considered to expanding to European markets like the Netherlands or Denmark by selling your product with subs for those regions? Or is licensing hell super bad?
Well, first off the bat, I'll have you know that it's the Scottish publisher here. There's an important difference, I say jokingly.
Yeah,
honestly.
Right.
Yeah.
But, honestly, we do release in other territories in Europe, you know, we release titles in France all the time. in France, we have a, like, titles we don't ever dream of touching in the UK, stuff like Attack on Titan, stuff like Ghost in the Shell Arise, the original Ghost in the Shell film, that kind of, like, a space captain, like, well, Cobra, for example, as well, and a lot of the other TMS classics, actually. Other territories in between, like the Netherlands and such, it's kind of a tricky area, and it's actually about cost versus benefit for subtitling as well. Mm-hmm. The licensing isn't so much a hell, it's more about, like, getting everything subtitled and getting it out on time, and proofing, like, QCing the content, etc. You don't have someone who's a native speaker in the office, that can cost a lot more money to have to go out of house. Would always like to try new territories, though, so you never know.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, maybe you'll expand someday. even more.
I can dream beyond the UK and France. Although I think our hands are quite full just now with those, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Sounds like you got your work cut out for you. So I think that does it for me. Thank you very much, Andrew. It was great having you on. Best of luck to you with the festival this year and everything you're doing with Anime Limited.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I hope to see you along here one of these years.
Yeah, I hope so, man. You just got to invite me. I'll be there the minute you say so. I'll be there.
Very tempted to find a way now, so definitely we'll try.
Okay, that's our show. Huge thanks to Andrew for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher Play Radio, Google Play Music. One of these days I'm going to get all of these right, and then you'll see. Anyway, leave us ratings and reviews. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you all next week.